we need to look at that and say, ho hum. We need to see our nation balance its budget and all of that, but our support is not tied into that. God has promised to care for us, plain and simple, and he's going to care for us. His reputation is on the line. And he said, don't seek these things, because after all these things the Gentiles seek. He told us, I will take care of you. And we need to trust in that. So, and I know what I was saying. Progressively, we learn that. And it seems to me like we learn it, I have to say for myself, I learn it through losses. The more things that I lose, the more I have to divorce myself from those things or become discouraged. Discouragement is not an option. Confidence in God is. And so I think we progressively free ourselves from these things through the leadership of God. The temptation here is a priority of wealth and material things. If you look with me in chapter 16 and verse 15, notice what he says about the Pharisees. Well, let's do 14 and 15. And the Pharisees also, who were covetous. Well, that defines where we are, doesn't it, subject-wise? Heard all these things, and they derided him. They understood what he was saying about mammon, about wealth, and about being given to it. And he said unto them, ye are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knoweth your hearts, for that which is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the sight of God. The things, and that's why I say that just wealth does not comprehend this whole issue, because the Pharisees wanted to be esteemed in the sight of men. And they used their position for that sake. So it's not just having the things of this world, it's having the approbation of this world. I think mammon covers both of those things. And the truth is, as believers, we cannot have the approbation of the world. Christ said to his disciples, if they hated me, they will hate you also. In the world you shall have tribulation. Be of good cheer, I have overcome the world. In the area of this steward, it appears that the foremost temptation he had, the earliest temptation he had, was to skim. He was in charge of his master's assets. And I think it's assumed in a thing like this with a steward of this nature that he's hiring people and he's paying for their labors and stuff like that. He's collecting together the master's crops and he's selling them and investing the master's money. And when he is accused here of wasting his goods, it would appear that he was probably doing something like skimming. And why would he do such a thing? Not many people had the opportunity to serve in a stewardship the way this man did in this parable. This is a rare man in the community, to be the steward of a rich man and have the freedom to do that. Why would he skim? Greed, plain and simple. And the greed comes because of his love of unrighteous mammon. You know, just recently in the news, speaking of the news, there's been this Whitefish Cooperative employee in Polson who embezzled over $65,000. Isn't that interesting? And I know when Charlotte worked in the bank, it got to the place where money was just paper. And that's the way these people look at it. It's just paper, you know. I think that's the way they deal with the opportunity to embezzle and greed, and they're greed by just, you know, it's just paper. It's just paper. From there, it is interesting what happened to this disciple or this steward. And Jesus told this parable for a particular reason. I think we need to look and see what happens. When he has to give an account for his stewardship, notice in verse 3 what he does. Then the steward said within himself, what shall I do? For my Lord taketh away from me the stewardship. I cannot dig. To beg, I am ashamed. I guess we'll assume from that that physically he wasn't able to labor in the fields. And maybe because of inactivity in all the years of his stewardship, you know. And he didn't want to beg. So facing that issue, he had to figure out what to do. Now, he saw only one option. There were two options, I believe. But he saw this option, verse 4. I am resolved what to do, that when I am put out of the stewardship, they may receive me into their houses. Well, what's he going to do? He's going to go and buy favor. How will I get elected in the next election? I will go out and I will buy favor of the electorate. It's a shame, number one, that people will do that. I didn't mean to become political tonight. And it's a shame others would allow it to be done. They would elect the guy. It can't see through that, you know. Verse 5. So he called every one his Lord's debtors unto him. And he said unto the first, how much owest thou, my Lord? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said, take thy bill and sit down quickly and write 50. Here is the temptation to shave. First he skimmed, and now he shaves. He is buying friends. It is interesting how much the Old Testament says about bribes and gifts and how they just ruin the heart. Yes, Ryan.
I wonder if all the 50 got back to the master.
If you what?
I wonder if all of the 50 got back to the master too.
Oh, wonder if all the 50 got back. Well, yeah, that's... You are just a skeptic or whatever. You're probably right, Ryan, but nevertheless. Then said he to another, how much owest thou? We're in the 16th chapter of Luke. And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said unto him, take thy bill and write 80. Now, here is an example of God's sarcasm. Verse 8. The Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. For the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light. Now, notice the sarcasm. I say unto you, make for yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when ye fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations. Did they have any everlasting habitations to receive him into? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And that's why I say to you, the steward had another option. He could have repented. He could have come back to his master and said, Master, I've been unfaithful. I'll repay that. And we'll sit down and we'll find out what the figure is right now. And so there would have been another option. But due to his being given to unrighteous mammon, he wasn't able to see that option. Verse 8 and 9 expose the power of mammon. The unjust steward's devotion to mammon, rather than repent and seek forgiveness, he furthered his unjust use of his stewardship to secure material gain. The Lord in this 16th, or in this story of the steward, is revealing to us the temptation to become tied to the mammon of this world. And I rather think that I don't know if I'm fair to say that, that we don't commonly understand its power, you know, and how it can get a hold of us and we'll become tied to it. But it's also good in the story, I'm kind of rehearsing myself here a little bit, repeating myself, it's also good to see what the examples were of his unrighteous use of mammon. One, he skimmed, he was dishonest. And two, he shaved, he bribed. Okay. Now, we can recognize that very easily, can't we? I think the areas where we find our conflict, if I can say, with mammon, that kind of thing, would be just what you brought up earlier tonight, Bruce. You know, should I buy that car? You know, or shouldn't I buy that car? Is this a proper use of the resources that God has permitted me to have? And some of us wrestle with that more than others, Bruce. And I guess, frankly, it's good that we wrestle with it, you know. But there's nothing immoral about that. You know, and I mentioned last Sunday that I'm so grateful that God has given us an Old Testament standard of the tithe. That gives us a little something to look at. The Lord delights in giving good gifts to his children. Yeah?
He made it quite sure, quite afraid he didn't appreciate diverting the funds that you've been promised to him.
Yes, right.
To pursue these earthly things, too. You know, I mean, the earthly things are above what, that's untouchable, what you're given to God. You know, I mean,
Yeah, there's several things there, and for our sake tonight, we can't go into all of that. Because it will get us high-centered. In verse 10 through 13, he encourages us to faithfulness. He that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. If therefore ye have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? And if you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. And I say this is largely something that we wrestle out between ourselves and God personally. And work that out. It was interesting. Again, I didn't mean to bring this subject up. I didn't bring this subject up with Roscoe and June this afternoon, but we got talking about it. We live really in a country that is awfully generous. And the wealthy of our country are really very generous. And this exploitation of the rich by saying they're just giving tax deductions to the rich. The rich people that I see in the news are generous beyond what is required of them. There was an article in Golf Digest this last week. The average golfer who makes a little, is a professional golfer, okay, on the PGA, on the tour, makes about $1.5 million a year. He pays half of that in taxes. Half of it in taxes. Now, I ask you, are the rich not taxed enough? That's a pretty substantial bite. But you take a guy like, let's just take one, the golfer we all love to hate right now, Tiger Woods. What has he done with a large amount of his wealth? He's created a foundation. And he is educating children. He's not required to do that. That's of his own free will. I'm sure his manager suggests he do it for his reputation. Probably the second wealthiest golfer who's golfing right now is Phil Mickelson. He has a couple of foundations himself. They were interviewing Arnold Palmer or the week before last when they played that tournament, the Shell. No, it wasn't the Shell. Anyway, it doesn't make any difference. And he's built a hospital down in Florida to treat preemies and things like that. Look what Bill Gates is doing with multiple billions of dollars, you know. So America is really a pretty generous group of people. The point of our story is, and this is what, when I read about these guys, whether it's Mickelson or Woods or Gates, they have a sense that this wealth they came by is not solely of their own making. I think that must come from a remnant of yet some Christian standards in our country, that they view that yet as something God has done for them. And, or they might say, the country has made available to them and they need to give back to it. We need to view our opportunities that way. I just got done reading I Beat the Odds by Michael Oher. Michael Oher was a young boy who was raised in West Memphis in the projects. He was in the social system most of his life and got wonderfully rescued out of that, and now plays professional football for the Ravens. He has been both right and left tackle. And in his book, he is encouraging people to use their opportunity to help others. In fact, he's saying, I beat the odds because there were people out there that helped me beat the odds. I hope that he was going to give a testimony of conversion to Christ and talk about being saved. He never did that. And but we need to view our lives as a stewardship. And that's what's happening here and what we're being encouraged to. It was the steward's responsibility, and as Christians, we have a much stronger motive for this. It was the steward's responsibility to faithfully represent his master and administrate his property. However, he was lured by the opportunity to ill-got wealth that his duties made available to him. Isn't that interesting? The temptation was in the very gift the master had given him. And I think we need to understand that. The temptation is in the very gift the master has given us. Life alone. This is one of the things our teenagers face. I think when they get up to, incidentally, I am beginning to think, you know, what's the Old Testament age of majority? Majority. Well, that's when bar mitzvah came, at 12 or 14. Well, I think it's 20. When God condemned the men in the wilderness, the men and women in the wilderness, who were not condemned? 20 and under. They weren't responsible for the choices. 20 and over were responsible for the choices. I wonder if it wouldn't be good for us to muse about that and meditate on that and think, because, for instance, our teenagers make some incredible decisions in their late years that they're not really capable to make, although you see them make it sometimes. Spurgeon, at age 14, got saved and started preaching at 16. Remarkable man. Remarkable man. But that is the exception, not the rule. For the most part, our kids, and I see them, that age 16 to 20, scares the wits out of me for our kids. Because that's when they are making incredible decisions about life. Is this life mine? Or does my life belong to him? And that's a huge, huge choice. And it's one that is so important. The steward began to serve his desire for wealth rather than his master's. Christ's warning, you can't do both. You cannot serve God and this world. Now, that's a rather large interpretation of mammon, but you can't do both. You do one or the other. And I think, you know, I look back when I was 19 years old, when I packed up all my childhood and adolescent dreams and put them in the trunk of my little Plymouth Belvedere, 1964, called it Susie, and drove out of Rockford, Illinois to Bible college, I thought that I had made the final decision to give God my life. But I have found that he's taken more and more and more and more the older I get. That was a good start back there. But I think it's not something that's done once and over. I think it's done once and confirmed, and it just gets deeper and deeper and deeper into us till Christ gets more of us, and what a glory and what a joy that is to us and to him, you know. Then there's a current illustration of unfaithfulness, verse 14 through 17. The Pharisees also, who were covetous, heard all these things, and they derided him. They were wrapped up, not in the things of God, but the things of the world. What was their stewardship? The Word of God and religion. That was their stewardship. Can you imagine perverting that to your own desires? Is that possible? Isn't that incredible? You see, when we give our lives to Christ, the battle isn't over. And here these guys had perverted that out of their covetousness, which they had not dealt with. And in their desire for the esteem of men, they had taken their position to gratify that. I made a point here. I write it down. They were not faithfully representing the law and the prophets, but were rather being enamored by their positions and the approval of men. They loved to be seen for their fasting and their praying. And they loved to be robed in these wonderful garments. And they exacerbated it by accumulating wealth and adopting pretense. Now, there is a ghastly comparison. This verse is often taken out of its context here. It's like all of a sudden, Lord, what are you doing in verse 18? Where are you going with this? Whosoever putteth away his wife and marrieth another committeth adultery, and whosoever marrieth her that is put away from her husband committeth adultery. Now, you tell me how in heaven's name that fits in this context. Exactly. It's the issue of divorce. Not divorce from our husbands and wives, but divorce from our devotion to God. The term adultery and fornication in the New Testament are used far more as metaphors than anything else for spiritual departure from God. And this giving ourselves to mammon is marrying the world and divorcing God. Oh, dare I take you here? I'm working on a new series of messages in the book of 2 Corinthians. And I have come on some stuff, again, where we go there and teach something that's not necessarily improper, it's very proper, but it's not contextual at all. We use that verse, "Be ye not unequally yoked together, as a manner of some is." And we apply that to marriage. We say to our daughters, "Don't marry an unbeliever." We say to our sons, "Don't marry an unbeliever." And that's a good application of that text. But that text, Paul is talking about a church who's married itself to the world. It is fascinating. Oh, I tell you, I don't know if I ever preach on it, but I sure love studying it. So here's that ghastly comparison, and it is a ghastly comparison, isn't it? Imagine being unfaithful to the one that you have covenanted your integrity to. Promise to love and to cherish till death do us part. Now, in the physical world and the divorce between men and women, that's going to happen because people break their vows and break their covenants. And sometimes for a good reason. You know, the husband becomes a drunkard and abuser. The wife becomes something like that, you know. And ultimately, the only reconciliation is you've got to bust that relationship. And I believe the scriptures back that, not opposed to that.
Doesn't that mess up this example?
No. That doesn't mess up this example at all, because God is not a drunkard or an abuser. And God in His mercy will never divorce us. He will chastise us. No, I don't think that messes up this example. Interesting question, Ryan. And that opens a whole other door. But tonight we won't walk through that door. Exactly, Matthew 19. And yeah. And if Moses allowed it, God allowed it.
When Christ was quoting that, he wasn't necessarily condoning that. But I guess that is for another night.
Yeah, that's for another night. There's some place I want to go before we get done, and I think I'm going to charge in there right now. Because as far as the rich man and Lazarus, we understand that story. An area where a stewardship was terribly distorted. A historical example of that is Roman Catholicism, where these men gradually came into authority and power in the Roman Church and distorted it for their own pleasure and wealth. And that was huge. I don't think that a lot of people understand how terribly distorted Roman Catholicism is, and how wicked it will be left to its own devices. It's under a lot of restrictions now because there's a lot more light than there was back in the feudal times. But you go back in the days of Charles III of Savoy and Charles V, the Roman Emperor, and Clement VII, the Pope, and Francis I of France, and Isabella and Ferdinand of Spain, and begin to read about that, and the wealth and the hypocrisy and the wickedness of the Roman Church, it is just incredible. So the warning sits to us that it is easy for us to pervert our stewardship and those kind of things. Now, that being said, I'm changing gears a little bit because I brought something to you here. My point being, we need to be devoted to God. And when people were beginning to rebel against the Roman Church, it wasn't always necessarily that they wanted to be devoted to God. They just saw the abuses of the church. And D'Aubigné sees, and he has written some things here that are just really fascinating. This is in Geneva. Geneva had kicked the Roman church out of town. The Huguenots were responsible for that. But the Huguenots were not devoted to Christ. They were just against Rome. Oh, this has just whetted my hunger to do. Because the Huguenots, whenever I've read about them, they've been a strange group. And Aubigné really gives me an idea of, oh, there's where that strangeness comes from. The partisans of absolutism, that is just sovereign governmental rule, and the papacy, rose up on every side against Geneva as if the Reformation were already established there. It was not so, however. Although Geneva had come out of Romanism, it had not yet entered Reform. It was still in those uncertain and barren places, that land of negations and disputes which lies between the two. A few persons only were beginning to see that. In order to separate really from the Pope, it was necessary, as Haller and Zwingli said, to obey Jesus Christ. Bonnevard, a keen critic, he incidentally was the Bishop of Geneva. Interesting story. Was indulging in his reflections in his large armchair at the Priory of St. Victor and carefully studying the singular aspect of Geneva at that time presented. A strange spectacle, he said. Everybody wishes to command and nobody will obey. From tyranny, we have fallen into the opposite and worst vice of anarchy. There are many tyrants as heads, which engenders confusion. Everybody wishes to make his own profit or private pleasure out of the common weal. Profit tends to avarice, and pleasure consists in taking advantage of him whom you hate. Men are killed, but they are not the real enemies of Geneva. If you wound a bear, he will not spring upon the man who wounded him, but will tear the first poles or the first tree in his way. And this, alas, is what they are doing among us. Having groaned under a tyrannical government, which is Rome, we have the love of license instead of the love of liberty. We must be apprentices before we can be masters, and break many strings before we can play on the lute. The Huguenots have driven out the tyrant, but they have not driven out tyranny. It is not liberty to do whatever we desire, if we do not desire what is right. O pride, thou wilt be the ruin of Geneva. Pride is always envy for its follower. And when pride would mount too high, the old crone catches her by the tail and pulls her back so that she falls and breaks her neck. The Huguenot leagues are not sufficient. The gospel must advance in order that popery may recede. It is Bonnevard himself who has transmitted these wise reflections. And he was not a reformist. But he stood there on top of this thing, and when the bishop who was bishop, got kicked out of Geneva, Bonnevard was put in his place by the Genevans. And I've got to read something else to you, too. You mind? They came to call on Bonnevard to talk to him. They rang at the gate of the monastery, and the janitor went and told Bonnevard, who ordered them to be admitted. We wish to put an end to all this papal ceremony, they told him. We desire to drive out all its ministers, priests, and monks. All that papacitical rabble. And then we mean to invite the ministers of the gospel who will introduce a true Christian Reformation among us. The prior smiled as he heard these words. Gentlemen, he said in a sarcastic tone, I think your sentiments very praiseworthy. And confess that all ecclesiastics, of whom I am one, have great need to be reformed. But ought not those who wish to reform others to begin by reforming themselves? If you love the gospel as you say you do, you will live according to the gospel. But if you wish to reform us without reforming yourselves, it is evident that you are not moved by a love for the gospel, but by a hatred against us. And why should you hate us? It is not because our manners are contrary to yours, but because they are like them. Aristotle says in his Ethics, continued the learned prior, an experience confirms the statement that animals which eat of the same food naturally hate each other. Two horses do not agree at the same manger, nor two dogs over the same bone. It's the same with us. We are unchaste, and so are you. We are drunkards, and so are you. We are gamblers and blasphemers, and so are you. Why then should you be so opposed to us? We do not hinder you from indulging in your little pleasures. Pray do not do the same for us. You desire to expel us, you say, and put Lutheran ministers in our place. Gentlemen, think well of what you are about. You will not have had them 2 years before you will be sorry for it. These ministers will permit you to break the commandments of the Pope, but they will forbid you breaking those of God. According to their doctrines, you must not gamble or indulge in debauchery under severe penalty. Ha ha! How that would vex you. Therefore, gentlemen, you must do one of two things. Either leave us in our present condition, or if you wish to reform us according to the gospel, reform yourselves first. Isn't that fascinating? There's a reason I'm sharing that with you tonight. Most of you here will not understand this because you've come upon the Christian life later. Bruce, you've been raised around this for a long time. This may make sense to you. Elaine, you were raised a Baptist, weren't you? This may make sense to you. I'll talk to you about a little bit of history. We have seen... Now, I'm painting with kind of a broad brush here, and be careful with that. But in much of what has been characteristically fundamentalism, there has been a great measure of hypocrisy in the last 100 years. And there are those who have quite clearly seen that hypocrisy. And they have rebelled against that and gone out to establish something different, but they have not devoted themselves to the scriptures. They have developed a hybrid, something that's different, and something that is not Christian. They've rebelled against their parents, if I can put it that way, but they have not devoted themselves to the scriptures. That is what we find in much, much, much of Christianity today. These adroit, capable, gifted rebels have gone out to establish a religion of their own logic and their own making, but not that of Christ. And that is much of what new evangelicalism is today. It is a hybrid that will not conform to the scriptures. And they have seen in their parents a commitment to what they call legalism. And they have rebelled against that legalism, but have endorsed the world. And this is broadly what's going on. I walked through this. I lived with people. And in my ministry in Wisconsin. And I scratched my head way out here. And it's only in recent years that I'm finally beginning to understand what in the world it was I was battling with. There was much to be rejected. But in rejecting alone is not the answer. In commitment to the scriptures is the answer. And they did not commit to the scriptures. Let me tell you how distorted this becomes. I just share with you a story that I heard last week from a trusted friend. Here is a pastor who is now in his 70s. He has lived his whole life as a pastor. Fundamental Baptist. His wife and adult daughter are in the home. The daughter is married. And she and her husband are visiting. And the mother and daughter are talking about when they work together on the bus route. And the father is listening in. And the daughter is talking about, you know, we used to spend 20 or 30 minutes every day before we went out calling, praying. The father said, you did not. And she said, well, Dad, yes, we did. You didn't. And he just got irate. You didn't. And she said, well, Dad, we did. And he stood up and he threatened to punch her in the mouth if she said that one more time. Can you imagine that? What I'm saying is, we can get busy about serving God and have no fruit of the Spirit or no nature of Christ whatever. And there was much of that in fundamentalism in the past. I think we need to own that. Say, yeah, that's true. Confess the sins of our fathers. And while we reject that, let's not reject the truth. And let's commit ourselves to the Scripture and not to building something that is false. No man can serve two masters. Either he'll hate the one and love the other, or else he'll love the one, you know. So that makes sense to me. That makes sense to me. We need to have a master. And the master needs to be this book. Because the temptations are incredibly tough. There is a scary line drawn between enjoying the gifts of God and worshiping God. And we're in that place. That's where I think of Wilson Mungo. He just shook his head. He said, I can't believe anybody with so much stuff still loves the Lord. I think it's incredible the strides Christianity has made in America, really. The issue lies in what we are tied and devoted to. Is it God or his gifts and the opportunities he gives us? We need to be tied to God.